As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome again to the baby brother of the ruck. I'm Owen Slott and this is How to Win a Grand Slam, a podcast about success. This is about what it takes to have an unbeaten season and how and why do some teams suddenly crack it. My guest this week has won three Grand Slams, all of them as captain. This is Will Carling, selected to play for England aged 22 and then, with only seven caps to his name, asked to step up and captain the side. It heralded the most successful period ever for England in the Five or Six Nations. Will, great to see you, and thanks for joining us on this great new novel experiment, How to Win a Grand Slam. You're obviously a good guy to talk to on this subject, because you captained your way through three of them.
Yeah, and I'm not being self-effacing, it's just that I didn't win three Grand Slams, obviously, myself. But, you know, yeah, I was part of three. We were part of three, which, yeah, I'm quite proud of.
Yeah, well, I know you don't want to say that you won them on your own, and I'm happy to go along with that. But yeah. But it is one hell of an achievement, and, I mean, three is extraordinary. Jason Leonard must have won four. He was on all your three, wasn't he? So no one else has won more than that.
I wouldn't think so. Certainly not an Englishman. In fact, not even, yeah, I wouldn't think any other countries have probably done that. Even the Welsh guys in the 70s only did three, I think.
If you look at the three, this is a bit like choosing your favourite child. Is there a Grand Slam or a Grand Slam year that is most special to you?
I think if there was, it would be the first one, just because we had messed it up a few times before and it was just a huge relief to actually win it. Not that, you know, the 92 or 95... There was that fear, I think, after sort of 90 or 89 that, wow, can we actually do this?
We should put that in context. So you won three Grand Slams, but we need to go back to where English rugby or England rugby was in the 80s. You won your first cap in 88.
Yeah.
In that Five Nations it was then. And England just weren't very good at that stage. Is that fair to say? Or weren't very good at getting results at that stage?
Yeah, England weren't very good, sadly. But I only got picked. We used to have final trials back then. Hmm. And it was meant to be Halliday and Buckton, and they both got playing in the centre. And they both got injured, which was tragic. So Kevin Sims and I played. But so I thought I'd get one game, maybe two. And we lost the first two games. Hmm. That's sort of what England did. You know, we lost to France away. We lost to Wales at home. Then for some reason, just, you know, little bits of luck, we managed to start. We won three games, which in those days was a hell of a season for England.
But when you lost those two games, or when you say three wins was a hell of a season, well, how did it feel amongst the group? Did the group feel frustrated, impatient because they weren't doing better, or were players at that stage just delighted to be picked for England and maybe playing for Bath and Leicester at the weekends might have been almost as important, if not more?
Well, I think that was one of the major problems with England, that people pretended that club rugby was more important. Now, maybe the Bath guys will turn around and say that it was, but I don't believe it. I think when you were a kid, any of those guys, you dreamt of playing for England. You didn't dream of playing for a club. And maybe you dreamt of playing for a club along the way, but your big dream, you know, as a player, was playing for England. I think the fact that England had been so poor for so long meant that people just didn't believe that England was ever going
to
work.
Did you find that immensely frustrating that you wanted to change it, or did you just think, oh, well, this is the way it is and this is what international rugby for England is like?
Well, I think the first few games you're just in a bit of a daze because you know you're playing for England and you still can't quite believe you've played for England. I couldn't. You know, you're just petrified the whole time. Every training session, every meeting, and certainly every game, you're just like a rabbit in the headlights. But then, and then maybe towards the end of the season, you know, when we won a few games, you're just thinking, actually, we should be able to do this more often. Mm-hmm. Or that's what I felt. And yeah, there's just a frustration that we just didn't have that kind of belief.
And did you feel that you were in a position to influence that in any way, bar what you could do on the pitch? Did you feel that you could influence the other players around you, or did that come later, probably not even when you started your captaincy?
No, I mean, I certainly didn't think I could influence anything. You know, they were all, they were my heroes. I mean, I'd watched these guys when I was at school on TV. And it is slightly surreal. You know, I remember Peter Winterbottom coming to play at Sedbergh where I was, and he was already a British Lion. In those days, you could do that. So we were playing an invitational side, and he was your hero. And people like Rory Underwood or Rob Andrew, these guys, you know, I'd watched for a while, and there's no way that you thought, well, I'm going to start telling you guys what to do. You were just delighted if they remembered your name.
Okay, so that brings you on to the captaincy. So you hadn't even completed the season by which time you were appointed captain.
Yes, well, so it was the first game it was the only game, I think, of November. So we'd sort of played that Five Nations, hadn't done particularly well, toured Australia, lost both tests, obviously. Yeah. And then we were playing Australia again in November, which is when Jeff made the unbelievable decision to make me captain.
You receiving the phone call from Jeff, you're at your mum's house?
Yeah. Well, he had rung.
And you thought the phone call was to drop you, correct?
Yeah. because that's what, you know, if Jeff rang you, because I'd played the last test and you knew that there was the Australia game was in a couple of weeks, and then you get a call from him, that meant you were getting dropped because he would talk to all the people, and that's the way it went. If you got a call from Roger Utley, who was the coach, that meant you were getting picked. So I thought, I'd turned up for dinner at my parents, and there was a message that he had called, and I just thought, oh. He just sat there for 20 minutes thinking, oh. And then I obviously had to ring him back. Yeah, slightly. It was just bloody surreal.
And you've asked a few times since, or asked out aloud, why was I appointed? What did he see? Have you ever got close to working that out? Have you ever actually asked him?
Yeah, well, it's brilliant because Lisa, my wife, we about 2 years ago, probably maybe 3 years ago or something, we were going up to pick up her mum, who lives up in Yorkshire, and I said, we're going to see Jeff Cook on the way for lunch. And she said, why? I said, well, because I've never asked him why he made me captain. And you could see the look on her face, was like, oh, this will be interesting. And so we drove up, and obviously I was sort of wondering why, coming out with this, that and the other, and we had lunch with Jeff, sort of got through the first course, and eventually I said, Jeff, look, I've never asked you why. And he was a classic sort of Yorkshireman, you know. You could see there was a slight smile on his lips.
But there were quite a few candidates that you would have thought were ahead of you at that stage, correct? Rob Andrew.
14 others.
14 yeah, others.
Yeah. Or more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Rob Andrew, Brian, Peter Whittemotz.
Brian Moore, Dean Moore. Richards. Yeah. There were loads.
So 14 better candidates. And he said he picked you because?
It was the last roll of the dice, he said. And I sort of looked at him, it was like, well, you forget, he said, we had four captains my first season. And he said, and we were getting it badly wrong. He said, and so we basically thought, last roll of the dice. So I was like...
And what does that mean, last roll?
He came up with another phrase, which ended in something or bust.
All right.
So it was just like, right, okay. And I sort of looked at him, because I was thinking, hopefully he'll come out with some really complimentary bits about me. And the smile was just like, you could tell he's thinking, no, I'm not going to. Yeah. And he just sort of said, so we just thought, right, let's try this one. And I was like, oh, great.
Thanks.
And Lisa said it was a much quieter journey on the way home, which was brilliant.
Was he suggesting that England needed a sort of a reset or to draw the line and start anew? I mean, that's how it's sort of remembered or portrayed, that you were the start of the new era or...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's really hard for me to say. But, geez, you have to go and talk to him. My view on it is, out of all of this, I think the guy who doesn't... He is the guy who never gets the credit he deserves out of England's sort of success in the 90s.
Right.
Because we will talk, you know, we will talk about sort of Grand Slams or whatever. He was the one in terms of his selection, in terms of the continuity in it, the environment he created. And, you know, when you look at how it changed under his guidance, it was huge.
So he sort of brought a new age professionalism to the amateur era, effectively.
Not only that, but he just obviously just worked out right. Because, you know, you look at England in the 80s, probably the 70s. My view on it was, I think England have always had good players, but they only used to keep them for a couple of games and then drop them, didn't they? Yeah, I mean, the churn was just ridiculous. So he was the guy who obviously just, it was like the Rob Andrews, Stuart Barnes debate. He obviously sat down and thought, I've got to make a call. Who do I think for the long term? And I'm going to give him a real go. And, and he obviously he went with Rob. And actually, if you look at the continuity in his selection compared to what had gone before, he stuck with guys. And, you know, 88 wasn't particularly successful. 89, you know, we lost down in Cardiff. And obviously, you know, 90, we lost in Scotland. But he stuck with the players who then obviously, you know, went on to win those Grand Slams. And I think that had never been done before by an English selector.
So in terms of how to do it, your team was allowed, enabled to learn from its errors, from its defeats, which in effectively in the past that didn't happen because it was, they've lost, let's try something else.
Yeah, and I think that's, when you I listened to someone like David Duckham, who was like one of my heroes, and you looked at those sort of players who went before, okay, most of the 80s, but the Nearies, you know, Cotton, when you look at, we just had some incredible players, but unfortunately, the lots of players around them just kept getting churned through. And you think at test level, you need some continuity. You need to sort of believe in each other.
That's what slowly happened between your appointment and 1990, which is a key staging post along the way for you.
Yeah.
In terms of how to win a Grand Slam, do you think you need to have gone through something like 1990? That was the big game. That if you'll remember for big games, that you probably remembered as much for that one as the World Cup final as well, in terms of the games that didn't go your way.
Yeah. Yes, and do you have to go through that? I suppose, you know, many teams probably don't. I don't know whether the English have to be really, really, really annoyed to actually react. I don't know, but we certainly were. And for me personally, I think 90, you know, we're not here to talk about the 91 World Cup, but 90, I probably got everything that you could get wrong as a captain. Yeah, I got it wrong. So
what did you get wrong?
Oh, just the build-up to it, the whole, in terms of our training was too good. We just were convinced that we would beat them. We were better than them. I didn't sit down with players and argue with them that, you know, we were underestimating them. There was a whole lot of talk from the 89 Lions tour when maybe the Scots guys hadn't done as well as they might have done, whereas the English boys did. And it was like, oh, we don't rate these guys. We're better than these guys. And at no point did I sort of go, well, hang on, guys. You know, we are underestimating a very, very good team. I didn't know my guys well enough when the game actually kicked off. I asked the wrong guys the wrong questions at the wrong time. You know, there was
lots. Did you not question them because you were still a comparative youngster amongst that team, and you were still surrounded by this army of senior alpha male forwards?
Yeah, and I think yes, and I didn't have the confidence to do it. And I also didn't want to be, you want to be liked. You didn't want to rock the boat. You didn't want them to just turn around to you and go, you know, oh, shut up. You know what?
I thought that was one thing you were quite good at, though, in terms of not wanting to be liked, not that sort of neediness, though maybe everyone's got that a little bit, obviously, but I thought you learned quite quickly that trying to be popular and being a good captain didn't necessarily go hand in hand.
Yeah, but I think that's maybe the bit you have your front, and I think if I craved one thing, probably way too much in my career, it was that I wanted people like Winters or Teague and Dino to think that I was okay. You know, as in, you know, yeah, do you know what? I sort of rate you. So that probably, certainly early on, affected me far more than it should have done. They were my heroes. I wanted them to think that, you know, I was a good player. I was a good guy. And after a while, you realise that actually, especially from those kind of guys, they're not going to think that just because you're nice to them.
That 1990 experience, I sort of asked, to what extent did it shape the team going forward? Because you won in 91 and 92 Grand Slams. How did it shape the team? Did it just make them just bloody desperate to get it right the next time round.
Yes, or... I think it probably restricted the sort of rugby we played. I think in 90 we probably played quite an open game. I think we scored a lot of tries. We probably played very well. If you look back, 91 was a far more forward orientated.
Was that batten down the hatches and not make any mistakes?
Just win the game.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think there was quite an effect of that. I think, you know, adventure was curtailed. It was like, look, we play territory, we play possession and we win.
So reverse back to 1990 again. How did the 1990 experience, so Murrayfield, grandstand beside you in Scotland,
yep.
As you say, you kind of expected to win. That's not the wrong word, but you did.
Yeah.
How did that affect you personally and shape your own sort of ambitions and determination?
Just, it shaped me massively because I think it shook you in the sense that if you could have been the cliche, arrogant English team going up there, well, we were. And we didn't consider how they would play, what they would do. And we didn't anticipate that they would put us, you know, out of our rhythm, that they would, you know, change the pace of the game. Lots and lots of stuff. Mm. And so afterwards, for me, it was brutal, you know, in the sense that you thought, yeah, I got a huge amount wrong.
And did you work that out for yourself, or did Jeff or someone have to tell you that?
No, I worked, you know, it was fairly bloody obvious. And I knew, you know, the guys that I had asked for information during the game were the wrong guys. You know, hence we made the wrong decisions, and, you know, which were my decisions, not anyone, you know. So you're thinking, yeah, you made all sorts of mistakes. And we'd been outthought, we'd been outplayed. I always say to people, you know, we were beaten. People sort of go, you lost. No, we were beaten. And we were. And that's what you've got to go away and think, wow, I don't ever, ever want to go through that again.
And do you think that game, that experience, 1990, had a big part in shaping the kind of person or celebrity, if you like, that you became in the media around then? Because you were made, whether you liked it or not, and you probably didn't, to symbolise, you was, came across as a sort of cross between Edward I and Margaret Thatcher, a sort of cartoon sort of English hero type, which I know very well is something that you've disliked and regretted, and it was sort of foisted upon you in many ways.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I don't know, this is not a therapy session, but I was having quite a deep discussion with my dad a few months ago, and I just said to him, Dad, I said, you know, one of the things that annoys me, you still think I'm this cartoon character that was, you know, the way I was portrayed. I said, I was never that guy.
Yeah.
And I never was. But it's, well, you know better than me, it's much easier to have, for the media to have this idea, and then that's what you write about, and that's what you play to, you know, it's much easier to write stories.
Did you get a spitting image character?
Yeah, I think so.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah. Had a huge pair of buttocks on his face. But but it just, yeah, you think there's your game face, there's the bit that you would sit in a media conference, press conference with, and then there's the real you, and it's very, very different. Then if you don't show anyone that, and I wasn't going to show anyone that, then how the hell are they ever going to know?
That's a reasonable point. You kept it well hidden for a long time.
Yeah, and I just think, and in a sense, I think you have to, because, again, for me, you worked out the purpose of me captaining England is not to try and be liked and be a popular, likable character. It's about, I want us to win. I want us to win games. I want us to win rugby matches. I want us to win Grand Slams. I want us to win World Cups.
You were a sort of a popular character in the English media for a long time. You were a sort of, especially when the Grand Slams happened, you became a sort of pin-up English sort of hero type.
Yeah, but that wasn't me. Do you know what I mean?
Was foisted on you.
Yeah, yeah. So you just sort of thought, actually, there's nothing I can do about that. And there really sort of wasn't. That's the part of, you know, let's build this image, let's build this hero. And you weren't, I wasn't the hero, and I didn't have all the good bits, and I probably didn't have all the bad bits. It's somewhere in between. And, you know, that, I think that's the case with lots of people.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From 1990 to 91, as you said, the England game changed. Was there a moment where you and Jeff or you and the team sat down and said, right, this is it, this is different, this time we do a different game?
I think from the very beginning of that 91 campaign, it was like, first game, this is about winning. And our focus was, right, we take what happened in 90 and... this time, you know, we win. And the first game was Wales away.
England hadn't won for 28 years in Cardiff?
Probably 30 or something, was it?
Well, it was
a long time.
Let's call it 130 then.
Yeah, it was a very long time. So yeah. You think there wasn't much more of a challenge that you could have as your first game where you think, yeah, okay, we haven't won down here since 60-something or whatever.
But you won that by 19 points, so you were in pretty good shape.
Yeah, but lots of little things, like people were amazed. We actually walked into the stadium. We didn't take a bus into the stadium.
Well, you walked through the city.
We stayed. Always, we'd always stayed out in Saint Pierre, Golf and Country Club, which was just over the bridge.
Right.
It was almost still in England.
Right.
So England had stayed there for 30 odd years. Had a lovely time. Could still see England, smell England. Then got in the coach, drove into Cardiff, lost,
holding your noses,
lost and went home. Right. Yeah. And I remember. Afterwards, you know, a whole debrief because we lost there in 89 and then we lost, you know, in 90 and we used to stay out in the middle of nowhere in Scotland as well. And there's a whole point, why don't we just go and stay in the middle of kind of get on with it? So we stayed right next to the ground, that hotel, right next to it. So, And we walked in, sort of kit bag, everyone got your kit bag. And then we walked in and I remember people's faces in the sort of hospital in the Cardiff club ground, you know, people were just like, wow.
Are they a bit lost?
Yeah. And I walked very close to all the forwards. And, but it was, in a way, it was an intent that, do you know what? This is different. We were different that day. It was more of an edge to us. There was more of a focus and intensity. It was...
And those are things you learn from defeat or from your determination through defeat.
Yeah. You just sort of think, you know, you just, for me, you know, that the pain that you go through of losing a Grand Slam and everything that goes with that, the English will always be, you know, they're the fall guy. They're the ones that people want to win against. Mm. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. It's just, it's history, isn't it? You're meant to be the big, you know, you're the big neighbour, and knocking England off its perch on a regular basis is joy to the Scots, the Welsh, the Irish. You know, they love it.
And did that game in Cardiff sort of set the tone, as in, one, the way you're going to play, two, the edge you needed, and three, a kind of confidence, if you like, that you could do this?
Yeah, to a great extent, yeah, it was. It was just, right, well, we've ticked that one off, that massive psychological hurdle for England, who, you know, hadn't done that for, as you say, 28, 30 years.
Yeah.
Then we had the Scots at home, so there was the 90 replay, and that was... an unbelievably sort of intense, dour game of rugby. There were very little frills.
Which you didn't mind at all?
No. Heslop scored a pretty, you know, it was an ugly try, but it was a great try. And we managed to win. It was the most claustrophobic game of rugby in terms of, as an English player, was just, we were so edgy and tight from the year before that whatever happened... We just thought, you know, we can't lose to these guys again. And ended up producing not a great display, but it was a win. And that was, I remember the feeling, the chamber was just like, right, that's another one. Another psychological thing, we chalked that off. Done.
That took you on to Ireland and then...
And Ireland, we nearly lost. Because it was the one sort of, we knew that the French were coming up, which, you know, maybe that would be the last game for, you know. And the Irish, we were losing with about 10 minutes to go. Because I hadn't focused enough on it. And we nearly got it wrong, and Rory actually ended up basically individually scoring a great try and getting us out of trouble. It's sort of bizarre, and that's the bit that, you know, I think is so amazing about Grand Slams. Certainly from an English point of view, is you get it slightly wrong, on any country, and they'll have you because that's what they want. And managing to get yourself to the emotional pitch every time is bloody hard work. And we didn't get there for the Ireland game.
But we got saved by Rory, effectively.
Yeah, basically we did. And then Teague scored right at the end. And he likes to think he saved it. But obviously, obviously he didn't.
Was that a reminder? In the changing room after that game, did you acknowledge we got away with that?
Yeah.
Because, yes.
Everyone sort of sat there and just, it was like, jeez, you know, unbelievable. It was just one of those, oh, you know, we nearly lost it. So that was, I suppose, you know, again, it was there was relief, but it just ramped up the pressure of, right, okay, so there's one more, and this time we don't get it wrong.
And you were never going to get the final one wrong.
No, but in a sense, so it was ideal for the French. When you look at the way the French played in, you know, like the first try, Saint-André's try, it probably is one of the great tries that have been scored at Twickenham. You know, Manel did the same. They were just, the French were like, right, let's just, you know, throw it around, and which is when they're at the most dangerous. And we're trying to close the whole thing down the whole time, trying to put our arms around everything, just going, stop this. And the more we were trying to do that, the more they're going, hey.
Yeah, you know, having so much fun, you guys.
Yeah, and it was horrible. But luckily, we managed to get there. And I think, for me, it was seeing the relief, the joy on people like Rory's and Winters, you know, guys who've been around a long time, I think was the bit that I loved the most, was just like, oh, you know, when you watch the final whistle, there's more relief than anything else in the sort of the expressions you see on players' faces.
How did you feel yourself in all that? Were you allowed to feel that as well, or were you marking your own emotions off what you saw from your teammates? Because it was your experience as well.
Yeah, I think I tried very hard to make sure, you know, you're very controlled about everything, and because you've got to be controlled about your emotions, you know, during the game. And I think it probably was a long time into the evening before you just actually managed to sort of just relax and think, oh, you know, thank God. It was more that than elation. It was just like, oh, you know, thank God we didn't get it wrong again. And you started, you enjoyed it a little bit more, got some pride, you know, in almost bizarrely in the weeks that followed it, where you just thought that was quite special. But first of all, it certainly was just like just sheer relief that we hadn't messed it up.
So how to win a Grand Slam, you've done 91, 92, was there a different approach? Was there a different way to win it then?
I think we played with a bit more freedom, but for me it was, I suppose all my frustration had always been as an England player was the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish, you know, allowed to be incredibly passionate.
Yeah.
And you know, and they're allowed to sort of talk about the passion for playing, and the English, we're not. If we talk about passion, we're branded as arrogant. And yet for me, since I was 7 years old, this was my dream. And I was as passionate wearing that shirt as anyone, you know, wearing the Welsh. So you respected all, and I did. I respected all that passion from them. But what frustrated me was, well, why aren't we allowed to have the same? And I think that's what we used to talk about a lot as English guys. I want us to have the same passion. It means as much to us as it does to them. The English are never regarded particularly as passionate people, but underneath it, when you dig down, we are. We just, there's layers of manners and sort of, and it's almost like, I think the English, we think winning regularly is a bit grubby. You know, it's a bit dirty. It's really not what it's all about. And you think, yes, it is. It is about winning.
And that conversation about being passionate and proud about your shirt and your country, was that something that you'd tried to encourage to bring out more from your team, or was it a sort of a process of evolution as you discovered that this is how you all were?
Well, I think for me there was a little bit of there was that part, and then there's a part of me which is very vindictive in terms of the Scots have beaten you, and you think if you win, then I'll never forget that, and I will always want to pay you back.
You were a bit obsessive about Scotland, though, weren't you?
Yeah, about Scotland. Same about Wales. You know, any of them. You know, they'd beaten you, and it was like, and I never forgot the look on people's faces when they as they walk off. Things like that. Never. I still remember it. It's just. Because, especially while I was wearing that shirt, that's my dream, and that hurts, really, really hurts. And so, yeah, I was quite driven in terms of I don't want to experience those things.
Did that passion, did you feel you were able to get it into your game more? Did that inspire you in 92? Or
I think I personally probably played, I had a little bit more freedom, but actually, while I was captain, I think I used to concentrate 90% of my time on captaincy rather than playing. There's part of me would think, if I hadn't been captain for that time, I'd like to think I would have probably been quite a different player. But really? I wouldn't change it.
How would you have been different?
I think I would have probably attacked more, you know, in terms of...
Oh, okay.
You know, developed my own game far more and...
So there might have been a little bit more me in it rather than us.
But, hey, I wouldn't change it. But I think, you know, my view was I put a huge amount of effort and emotion and time into the captaincy part of it.
92 was a very convincing Grand Slam.
Yeah.
You won every game with quite a cushion.
Yeah.
So you as a team felt, you must have felt very confident. You must have had a great awareness of the quality that you had at the time.
Yeah, I think what we managed to do was understand almost like the emotional wave that, you know, you get yourself up for a game and then you have to let yourself come down and then work very hard to get yourselves back up for the next one.
Yeah, so you were mastering the process at that stage.
Yeah, and I think we all generally sort of understood this is what it takes, and so there was a collective, you know, at training it was like if people were messing around, there was far more of a collective, you know, let's get focused, guys, you know, this is what we got to do, this is what we got to do. There was the belief, far more belief in each other, and so yeah, I think, you know, 92, as you say, most of the games were fairly comfortable wins.
It was a team that was coming to its peak age wise, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was where one team effectively finished and another team had to start after that.
Well, and I think probably should have done, whereas I actually think 93, that was a pretty similar team.
Oh, you went on too long?
Yeah, and I think it went on a year too long. And I think possibly, although Jeff probably wouldn't thank me, Jeff was, you know, managing the Lions. I think there was a thought of the Lions maybe, and some of those guys would be good for the Lions tour. And whereas from an England point of view, I think that the team should have probably evolved in 93 far more than it did. And 93 ended up being our worst year ever.
So 93 was a poor year. 94 was, do you regard that as like a building year? Because you sort of had achieved, well, you come to fruition again in 95.
Yeah, 94 was an annoying, a ridiculous game against the Irish. It was the only one that we lost at Twickenham, I think, in my time as captain.
Was it?
From the, yeah, Five Nations. You know, it was the only time we lost there, and we just got it badly wrong, which was, really frustrating, because otherwise we beat the others. So 94, yeah, a lot of new faces, but it was one that was, we just, through lack of focus and concentration, we threw away another Grand Slam.
So by that stage, you had the likes of Tim Rodber had come through.
Yep.
Ben Clark had come through.
Yep.
Bayfield was established himself. Martin Johnson was just coming through.
Yep, Jono was in.
Half decent players then.
Yeah, Jono still hadn't spoken. I don't think he came in 93. I think his first words were first in 95, I think he spoke. Yeah, there were some good guys. And in the back, there was a few changes. Hunts had been in and around. There were a few changes. Tony was around, so yeah, there were quite a few new faces.
And did you feel that when you got to 95, did you feel that you recognised in that team what you'd seen before? Did you think we've got another team that can do it?
Yeah, I think 95 was probably at the very beginning the only time that there was overt talk about, right, after 94 and after 93 was, right, we won a Grand Slam this year. You know, we'd messed around for 2 years.
Right. You sat down and
yeah,
we're going to do it this time.
Yeah. So, you know, the focus has got to be absolutely 100%. You know, we've got to get back on, you know, and we've got to make sure we make the effort and the focus and the concentration, and we don't just expect it to happen, which is probably what we had done in 94. So 95 was about, you know, no, we make it happen.
Anything particularly different that characterised that 95 team?
I think we had, when you had Rodber and Clark, you had a massive pack of forwards.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we'd had a powerful pack of forwards in 91 and 92, but there was quite a nice balance when you think, and then you had Tony and Rory on the wings and Jerry. So there was quite a few different ways to be able to play, and Mike Catt at fullback, he was, you know, was a great footballer, and Kieran, you think, at scrum half. So you think, actually, you know, there was a flexibility in terms of being able to play wide or just use the power. So it was quite reassuring as a captain, though. You had you had variety.
And did you, as captain, had you changed a lot by that stage? Did you have a confidence? Did you feel you know what you were doing? Were you still nervous that they didn't like you? Or, I mean, how much did you change by that stage?
I think a lot of the characters, so a lot of the guy, you know, Winters had gone, Teague had gone, you know, so quite a few of those, you know, Wade had gone, sort of my initial sort of, you know, oh wow, guys, yeah. Rob was still around, Rory, you know, Dino. So there were a few, but yeah, I think I probably had moved on to realizing that, yeah, certain things you're going to say are not going to be popular, but they're the right things to say.
So you were more right happy making those calls then?
Yes, but... and I still remember that the last game of the 95 was against the Scots, and I remember giving a talk the night before about what it was like to lose to them. And I remember Mike Catt and Victor sort of sitting there with these puzzled looks on their face, you know, and had no idea what 90 was all about. And
So there you are. You were still banging on about 1990.
Yeah, damn right.
And they were rolling their eyes going, get over it, mate.
Yeah, I think I was at school. You know, what are you talking about? And it was just like... You know, I don't know what you're talking about. And it was like, I said, well, you will do if you lose tomorrow.
Yeah.
So it had an effect on me.
But you use it to drive, you learn from it. That was the whole point of it.
Yeah. And that's just, for me, I think I've always been, you learn and you use the emotion, you use the memories, and that's what drives you. And it's not just the game stuff. It's the training. It's the thinking. It's making sure that, you know, we don't make the mistake in terms of anticipating what they'll do. All the preparation. It's just like, guys, and it sort of drives you to get all that stuff right.
Not surprisingly, as you would expect, but you put obviously a lot of thought and a lot of emotion and energy and time into your captaincy and how you're running the team. Did it dominate your life for that period?
Yeah, completely. I remember, you know, the amateur days, and I remember.
But you had a job. You had, you know.
No, I didn't. Right. Well, I did.
Well, you sort of did. You ran a company, and
yeah. But the thing is, you forget. It's like, so I had a job with Mobil Oil, and then after about 18 months of being captain, I gave it up. And I remember going home for dinner, and my mum, I said, oh, I've given up my job at Mobil Oil. And she said, why? I said, because I need to concentrate on the captaincy. And she said, what are you going to do for money? And I remember saying, I don't know. And I didn't know. But my view was, there was so much to do, and they didn't have the entourage that the England do now. And there was a huge amount, and I wanted us to win. And so you just, I'm trying to think how I sort of stumbled through. I think I set up a company, but, you know, people certainly weren't asking for you to come and talk about leadership because we weren't winning anything. So it was just like you stumbled around and cobbled together bits of money. I'm not quite sure how, but it was like wasn't the bit that was important to me. It was captaining England and trying to get us to win games and all the effort that was needed.
Do you think that winning a Grand Slam in an England shirt is harder than any other?
Yeah, I do. I might be biased, but I do, because I think...
Yeah, you sort of suggested that, sir.
Yeah, and people go, oh, God, yeah, well, he would. But if you go back, and people say things have changed now, but I think if you ask the Welsh or the Scots, or even the Irish, who's the what, if you could only beat one team...
Yeah, still the
I think
same,
it's still
isn't
the
it?
English. So you think it's... Yeah, but that's the challenge. And then you think, and okay, it's in England, but if you talk to a New Zealander, I mean, you talk to the All Blacks, they deal with that every game they play. Mm. You know, and they deal with it, you know, far better than England have. So, and they have done for decades, and, you know, it's incredible. So we got to aspire to that.
Do you have regrets at all, or do you think at all about the fact that you could have and arguably should have won a fourth Grand Slam in 96? I mean, 96 you lost to France and...
Yeah, but I think the same as 94 should have been.
You just didn't get it right that day.
No, we stupid penalty against the Irish, we weren't focused enough on it.
Which goes back to what you were saying before, that to win a Grand Slam, you've got to get it right. You've got to be on
absolutely.
Every single time.
You've got to get yourself back to that emotional pitch. And that takes, emotionally, I think it is more draining than physically. Mm. And I think that still applies. And I think it's understanding, genuinely, as a group of players, how you get yourselves up, how you allow yourselves to come down, and then how you work like hell to get yourselves back to that pitch again, and you get it slightly wrong and you'll get beaten. And it's an emotional effort almost more than a physical one.
Which brings me to sort of final two questions, one of which is, if you're talking to the captains of the Six Nations, how do you win a Grand Slam if you had one piece of advice?
Oh, it's about instilling the confidence in your team and caring about your team. If you can get your team to deliver their best every game, then you stand the chance of winning a Grand Slam. Sounds easy. I mean, even now, five games, it's all the history and the emotion that goes with it. It's hard to do, but if you can manage to make sure all your guys get themselves back to where they need to be for every game, you stand a chance.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air. The podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.